This is the Mason Vera Payne Show, your go-to lifestyle program, covering everything from technology and gaming, to movies, TV shows and pop culture, to the supernatural and beyond. Brought to you from Chicago, USA, with your host, the unabridged millennial, Mason Vera Payne.
Mason Vera Payne here, live from the MVP Studios in Chicago, and thank you for tuning in. With the advancements in technology, investments are pretty diverse. Knowing what to invest in, especially in the 21st century, is kind of tricky. Joining me to break down investing in a new age is founder and executive chairman of Edelman Financial Services, Rick Edelman. Thanks for joining me, Rick.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Could you tell me a little bit about yourself? How did you get into being a financial advisor?
Well, back in the 1980s, my wife and I, as a young married couple, wanted to buy a house and do everything that young married couples want to do. And we went to a financial advisor, and he ended up giving us really bad advice, actually told us to lie on our mortgage application, commit a felony. And we were just really infuriated that that's what he would say. And so we decided, you know what, we're going to learn how to do this ourselves, and we're going to teach others what we've learned so that people can avoid the bad experiences that we had. And that was the basis of creating our financial planning firm, which we did in 1986. And now, today, we're one of the largest financial planning firms in the country with 43 offices across the U.S. and 35,000 households that we serve.
So you're self-taught? There wasn't any college course you went and took?
No, there weren't any back then. I mean, financial planning didn't really exist in the early 1980s. There was no college course. Today, there are hundreds of colleges around the country that offer degrees in financial planning, but that didn't exist back then. I was one of a relatively small group of people who pretty much invented the financial planning field. I ended up teaching at Georgetown University for 9 years, teaching personal finance, and I have written 9 books, the number one New York Times bestselling author, and we now provide a lot of financial education, but it really didn't exist when I was getting started.
Wow, so you're like a pioneer. You just trailblazed through and made it a brand new career for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's really funny. When we started doing college planning seminars in the 80s, we used to teach them for elementary school PTAs. And they used to say, why are you talking to us? Our kids are 8 years old. Go to the high school PTAs. But they didn't realize that by then it's too late. You've got to plan for college when the kids are young. Today, people get it. They understand the need for long-term planning and investing. But that was a new concept in the 1980s.
Well, you know, it's so funny. That's so true. Growing up for myself, I know that they were always telling me, hey, you need to plan for your retirement. And I'm like, hey, I'm only 15. Why should I care?
Exactly. But of course, the benefit is that the sooner you start, the easier it is to achieve the goal because of compounding, money earning money on money. I mean, we all are trained in America to get an education, get a good job, make a lot of money. But what we're not taught is how to make money with the money we've made. And that's what financial planning is all about, how to get your money to work as hard as you do.
One of the things I remember they taught in school is, oh, invest in CDs. Just take as much money as you can and put it in a CD, and then, you know, 30 years later, it'll be something. Does that still stand true now?
No, it doesn't. That used to make sense back in the 1980s and 1990s. Back then, you could get a bank CD that paid 15%. That was really something. But today, as we know, bank CDs are paying 0.0. They're very low rates of interest, and they are not earning enough to keep pace with inflation. So while it used to make sense 20, 30, 40 years ago, today it's a terrible idea.
So what do you do? I mean, if you don't have that much money, you know, like maybe you only have $10,000 to spare at, you know, in your mid-20s, what do you invest in then?
Well, the good news is that the financial industry has really grown up over the past couple of decades, and there now is a wide variety of investment opportunities that don't take a lot of cash. Mutual funds, exchange-traded funds are really terrific opportunities. We use them for our clients exclusively. Our household minimum is only $5,000, so we can serve just about anybody. Most of our clients have hundreds of thousands or millions, but we have lots of clients who have $5,000, $10,000, $50,000 that they're saving for college or for their own retirement or to buy a house or what have you. And the nifty thing is that you can now build a very sophisticated globally diversified portfolio, just like the big institutions and endowments and pension funds do. You can do it as well with just $5,000 or $10,000 using mutual funds and ETFs, and that's exactly what we show our clients how to do. So don't feel that you don't have enough money to invest, that the only choice you have is a bank account. That's simply not the case anymore.
You know, the way the internet is made, everything seems to be like DIY. Is this something that you should do on your own, like just make an E-Trade account and go nuts?
Well, I am a professional advisor, so I'm biased. I believe in the value of advice. Yes, you're right. It is very easy today to do it yourself. There are lots of online services and sites that allow you to open an account. My firm does it as well. At Edelman Online, you can open an account with us without ever having to talk to a human. So we all make it very easy for you to do this on your own. My concern, however, is that you can't ask those online sites questions. They really don't know anything about you other than what their algorithm is trained to process. So I'll give you a perfect example. If you go to E-Trade, the site you mentioned, or any of the others, and say that I have $5,000 to invest, can you open an account? They'll say yes, and they'll show you how to do it, all online, very quick, very easy, very simple. But what they won't ask you is, do you have credit card debt? Because if you do have credit card debt, that's where your $5,000 should go, to paying off that debt, not to opening an account with them. Do you have cash reserves? If you don't, that's where your money ought to go. Are you maximizing your 401k? If you're not, that's where your money ought to go. So only when talking with an advisor and getting actual advice that's in your best interest, we might discover that what you thought you wanted to do is not what you really should go and do, that there might be other things going on in your life that you should be focusing on first. They also will not necessarily volunteer to give you advice about your car, should you buy it or lease it, or your home mortgage, or getting a will, or maximizing your employee benefits at work. This is why there's a tremendous value in talking with an advisor who can learn about what's going on in your life, understand your situation, ask you about your goals, get to know how you feel about risk, and design a strategy comprehensively, not just about investments, but about every aspect of personal finance, to make sure that you're achieving your goals and taking care of it as best as you possibly can.
You know, it's always good to have a financial plan when you're young, but what about when you're older? I mean, is it ever too late to make a financial plan?
Not unless you've been diagnosed with a terminal illness in the next 6 months. And even there, we would argue that people do need estate planning for their benefit of their heirs. So no, it's never too late. I mean, even if you're 65, your life expectancy is 88. And by the time you are 88, your life expectancy will be beyond that. My mom is 90 and going strong. So it's never too late. We're not really concerned with what you didn't do in the past. We're not going to beat you up for the mistakes or missed opportunities of the past. We're more interested in where are you now, where do you want to go? And we'll do it by looking at all aspects of tax law and insurance and mortgages and employee benefits, and we'll look at investments, and we'll look at everything with a dollar sign, so that you can get where you're trying to get as easily and as quickly and as safely as you possibly can.
I've actually read part of your book, The Truth About Your Future, that it came out in March, and it's actually really cool. The beginning portion of it is all about like technology and things you should look out for. In a way, is this book kind of like telling you what to look for in the future or what you should keep your eye out for?
It really is. Most of us don't realize how rapidly technology is changing everything. Robotics, 3D printing, nanotechnology, bioinformatics, big data, all of these are going to have an incredible impact on every aspect of life on the planet. It's going to alter careers. It's going to alter housing, leisure and recreation. It's going to have a tremendous impact on your investments. And so the book, as you cited, is in two parts. The first part explaining what all these technologies are, and the second part revealing what it means for your personal finance. And it's really important that we take a serious look at where we're headed, because as Yogi Berra said, the future ain't what it used to be.
When it comes to looking at a company, when you're doing research on a company and you notice that they're not really handling technology that well, like they're not trying to push it, should you invest with them anyways? Or is it something that like, put money in it now and then maybe a year later I'll take it out?
Well, we should invest with a long-term perspective, and so we, I believe, should have a view as to the future viability of a business. The best example I can give you is Kodak, probably the best brand on the planet, best-known company in the world, 135 years old, nearly 150,000 employees when it went bankrupt in 2012 because they couldn't make the shift from film to digital photography. And in the year Kodak went bankrupt, Instagram, with only 18 months old with 13 employees, was sold for $1 billion. So we need to recognize that companies that were built to succeed in the 20th century are often not going to succeed in the 21st. And so you need to take a very critical eye to your investments. Do you own companies that were built for the last century, or are you investing in companies that are going to succeed in this century? And you want to make sure you're dealing with an investment advisor who has that critical eye as well.
You know, that makes me think of holograms. I remember there was a concert and there was a hologram of Tupac, and people were like, oh my God, that's like the next best thing. That's the future. And the company who made the hologram, they went bankrupt. So I'm always on the fence when it comes to technology, because if you keep pushing it, some of the times that stuff doesn't work out too well for those companies. And other times, like you said with Kodak, you know, if they don't advance with technology, they're going to be left behind. How do you know where to go?
You're exactly right. Technology is only as good as today, and tomorrow there will be somebody better. Remember MySpace? It was killed by Facebook.
Yeah.
Borders Books was killed by Amazon. So you always have the next technology that's going to defeat the current latest and greatest. And that's why instead of investing in companies that are issuing and producing the latest technology, I prefer to invest in companies that are using the newest technology. In other words, although the company that made that hologram might be bankrupt, the company that used the technology to stage a concert might very well still be in business. In other words, using the technology to build a business rather than investing in the technology itself is often a much smarter way to go.
There's another part of your book that I thought was really interesting. Is like it says 175 jobs least likely to be lost to automation, and then 171 jobs most likely to be lost to automation. And how did you compile this list?
Well, the list was produced by Oxford University in a study that they had done to demonstrate that technology, particularly robotics and artificial intelligence, are going to eliminate about half the jobs that currently exist in the United States. And they list very specifically what those jobs are, and I published the results of their study in my book, The Truth About Your Future. And whenever I talk about that in my seminars, that's when people flip through the book to see if their job is on the good list or the bad list. Anything that is automated, repetitive, redundant, will be taken over by robots and machines. So it's not just ditch digging or bricklaying. We already have robots that do that. We're also talking about white-collar jobs like mortgage loan processors, accountants. I mean, you can buy Quicken software to do your own tax return. We have a great many white-collar occupations that all they're doing is pushing paper. They're filling out forms and processing it along. Computers do that faster. They do it cheaper and always completely accurately. So you have to really ask yourself, is the job I'm in likely to be eliminated by technology? And if so, the sooner you figure that out, the better, so you can begin to get retrained into a field that is going to succeed in the 21st century.
It's funny. You're right. I went to the list and I was checking to see if my job was up there. And I actually found my father's job recently. He works at a steel place, and they grind steel plates and do all this other stuff. And I think in the past year, they bought a machine, and it's a shot blast, and it just throws these little pellets at the plate and it grinds it in half the time that it would take him to do it. So it's that stuff is happening now. And I think that's kind of crazy. But, you know, in his case, a machine is taking over his job already. And he's 59. What does he do? I mean, like, does he go back to school?
Yes. he goes back to school. That's the key. In other words, it used to be that if you wanted to succeed economically, you got a college degree. Today, lifelong learning is the key. It's no longer an issue of getting a degree in your 20s, because the knowledge you gain in that degree is going to become worthless over the next 10, 15 years as it becomes outdated. So you have to go back to school, not just your dad at age 59. All of us have to continually retrain ourselves. Otherwise, the information we have becomes stale and obsolete. So lifelong learning is the key. You have to factor this into your lifestyle. You'll go back to school and you'll emerge in a totally new career, totally new discipline. Remember that the smartphone has only been around for about 10 years. The iPhone just celebrated its 10th anniversary. Today, we have 300,000 Americans working full-time as app developers for the iPhone. They're making 100 grand a year. This is a product that did not exist 10 years ago, and we now have 300,000 people making a lot of money at it. So we have to recognize that while technology will eliminate many jobs, it also creates many jobs, and usually those jobs are better. They're higher paying. They're more rewarding than the jobs that are getting replaced. So you're absolutely right. The key is to engage in lifelong learning.
I'm glad you talked about pay. I spoke with someone a few weeks ago about cryptocurrency. Do you think there's a future in that in investment terms?
Yes, I believe in the future of Bitcoin and Ethereum and other digital currencies. It's a wild west right now. They are not considered investments by the government. The SEC says they are not securities. The IRS says they are property and taxed accordingly. There is virtually no regulation, and therefore it is wildly speculative. There are more than 800 digital currencies that exist today. Ethereum is only 9 months old. It's impossible to tell which currencies are going to survive, and will there be some new currency that gets developed? Will they be created by governments, which so far have not yet created any digital currencies? Might they start to do that? So I do firmly believe in the future of digital currency. That doesn't necessarily mean that Bitcoin and Ethereum or Litecoin or any of the others are necessarily the ones that will survive. But I do believe it is appropriate for everybody to get familiar with digital currency and, more importantly, the blockchain, which is the underlying technology that allows digital currency to exist, because this is going to radically transform virtually all aspects of the financial services industry.
Well, thank you so much, Rick, for coming on. I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to do this. For those that are listening and are interested in you and your book, where can they find that at?
Well, my book, The Truth About Your Future, is available at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com, your favorite bookseller. And you can reach me at RickEdelman.com. That's RiceDelman.com.
This has been the Mason Vera Payne Show. Thanks for listening. Can't wait to hear more? Head to WGNradio.com for exclusive content by Mason. Also, follow Mason on Facebook and Twitter at Mason Vera Payne. That's all one word. And don't forget to share the show with your friends.